Hello, this is Chris Robinson of the West Harlem Museum. This is the first podcast of a series I'm going to offer of tales rounding about Fort William. And we'll start off with the story of a township above Fort William, not far away from the town, some tales and truths beyond the cattle grid. The West Highland town of Fort William is a thriving tourist centre, while still an industrial town. It can date its recorded history back to the castle of Inverlochy, which in the first millennium hosted emissaries from Charlemagne in France to barter and buy salmon from the River Lochy. The Commons built a moated castle, Old Inverlochy Castle, on the banks of that river, which saw two battles in 1485 and 1645. At the time of the Commonwealth, a wooden palisade was built at the mouth of the River Nevis, known locally as An Gishton Dhu, the Black Garrison, or to others as the Fort of Inverlochy. Attempts at suppressing the local clans met with an uneasy peace, only to be shattered again in 1745 when Bonnie Prince Charlie raised his standard just a few miles away at Glenfinnan. The failure of that last campaign to reinstate the Stuarts to the British throne in 1746 changed the Highlands forever. A new light was lit, though, from the south when the romance of Macpherson's Ossian presented a stage for play and passion in the Highlands. That promise did not shine into the dwellings of the inhabitants, however, who were often relocated to poor ground or left these lands never to return. Queen Victoria followed her predecessor, King George IV's interest in Scotland, penetrating much further by steamboat into the Highlands, along what was to become the Royal Route, much exploited by McBrains, as the tourist hordes followed in her wake. But it was the foresight of Lord Kelvin, who harnessed the natural resources of the mountain and rainfall to turn turbines, and when Lochaber's aluminium industry was born. Paper production, sawmills, fish farming flourished, at least for a while. Tourists no longer follow royalty, but travel the A82 or the scenic West Highland Railway line. But above the tortuous trail is the A82, at the west end of the town of Fort William. A modest rising road takes the motorist or pedestrian to a different place. Modest it may be, but not so modest as it was once upon a time. It's a Wade Road built by General Wade. If you had seen this road before it was made, you would lift up your hands and bless General Wade. Up through the houses of Upper Akintore, which teeter over the town, and beyond the cattle grid, leads a road, no longer a thoroughfare to the south, but a single-track road to Lundevra, taking in the crofting township of Blamafortuch. It once led past other thriving settlements, Glengower, Blarachurin and Tolly, now abandoned or left as a house or two as a token of times past. At the cattle grid, a gated track leads above the houses of Upper Akintore to the summit of Cow Hill, where a mast serves the TV screens for all those it surveys. But just before these houses were built, I went in search of the Rotten Egg Well, just where those houses were. Duncan Dinky Cameron, a tiring heavy man, but still with a flame in his eyes, he told me about the Rotten Egg Well. When a young boy, his mother had sent him on errands to the well to bring back a jar of the stinking stuff. It was for his younger sister, bedbound with rheumatic fever. And on the hillside I found a patch of yellow-green slime descending over a peat bank with sulphurous smell. In 1860, attempts to exploit the potential of this local asset were thwarted when official scientific analysis of the waters failed to show any real potency and the peat bank remained untouched. Fort William's aspirations to be a spa town and a West Highland Mecca were dashed. But somewhere in Upper Akintore is a nice detached house with not just fairies at the bottom of the garden. Now up the steep road to the first summit, a and a large passing place with a picnic spot and fine views of the west face of Ben Nevis on a clear day. In winter, as the snow clears, the zigzag path to the summit, built to service the observatory there in 1883, can be seen. And on a fine day in summer, the eye can follow the line of that track by the coats of many colours of the pedestrian climbers of Ben Nevis. In the late evening, there may be one or two cars stationary in the lay-by. Motorised courting is the new way, replacing the once popular lover's lone. The walk up this hill to descend following the banks of the River Cashnish and back hand in hand to Fort William. "Lassie, will you come up with me to Blamafolchuk?" was once an offer which could be knowingly accepted or refused. But at the other end of life, a local remarking, "He'll soon be going down the glen," was a byword for the visit to a different glen, Glen Nevis, where lies the graveyard. But back towards Blamafolchuk, where the years are young and the horizon wider. A little way down the hill is Glengower, now with two fairly modern houses. Behind them is a corn kiln and the remains of the old house, which is remarkably intact, with much more than the usual stunted gable end. Local lore has it that this house was visited by the plague with fatal results. And years later, a party of men set to work plundering the stone, but one of them became gravely ill and the stones were left standing. Further local custom tells that plague victims were not buried in consecrated ground. And further up the glen, outside the small hillock graveyard, of which more later, are two weeping willow trees planted to remember them. At the bottom of the brae is a small burn, and alongside parts of its banks are heaped high with lines of stones left from the day a thunderstorm broke the wall of the embankment of Corrie Lochan, high upon the hill from whence the burn flows. This small lochan is in a band of limestone with soft mud dangerous for sheep about it. The alkaline waters encourage plant and insect life, which in turn can produce quite large but difficult to catch trout, though I once caught one of over a pound in this puddle. Another fishy story comes from Duncan MacDonald, a tall, moustached, ex-military, nicotined man who once commanded the Rod and Gun Shop in Fort William. He had it that he personally had stocked Corrie Lochan with trout. He'd carried several small fish caught in Loch Lundevrar further up the glen. They travelled in his upturned southwester on a particularly wet day. This little loch was once Fort William's main water supply, and the remains of a sluice gate which controlled the outflow into pipes lower down the hill is still there, well above the present water level. A more dependable flow was later sourced from the River Nevis. That little burn winds down to the River Cashnish, where in 1896 a local initiative supplied electricity to Fort William. The Fort William Electric Lighting Company built a half-mile-long aqueduct contouring the hillside, passing through a dammed lock with an overflow weir into a channel, which led to descending pipes down to the turbine house with its two 60-watt generators. A steel cantilever bridge spanned the River Cashnish, giving access to the works. Nowadays, it's the Rickety Rackety Bridge, offering a daring and dangerous route to the remains of the turbine house. A line of wooden poles carried the power down to the town. Fort William claimed the distinction of being the first town in Scotland to be lit by electric light in 1896 from the Battery House in Bank Street. At the time of its demise in the 1930s, the turbines were removed, and the tender for the demolition of the remaining building was won by Donald Cameron, auctioneer of Glen Nevis. During its dismantling, peculiar stains were noticed leaking down the walls from the roof space. Further exploration revealed the hive of a large colony of wild bees that had colonised the building. He's told that the sale of the honey more than offset his outlay on the task. The electricity supply was not robust, and when Charlie Morse, as a young man, worked in the Highland Hotel, he remembered that they'd acquired a new and enormous electric toaster. And when this was switched on, the whole town supply would falter, prompting frantic phone calls from the battery house in Bank Street. But back to the Caishnish, and beneath the bridge is the yellow pool with a wedge-shaped rock, known mostly to poachers, where many a salmon left the water. The crofting township of Blamafortuk is guarded by another cattle grid. There proceeds an undulating road with small houses and byres above and below the road. It's a convivial community, aware of their lofty and lonely status above the town. One Sunday lunch, Gus MacDonald, the pigman of the township, who had first come to Fort William to work on the construction of the British Aluminium Factory, entertained. Mrs. MacDonald had several worthies around the table, and all had been supplied with a pre-dinner dram. One of the company was Jimmy the Tramp, a loner but known to all, who lived in a caravan out at Lochielside and was never far from his bicycle, which he pushed but rarely rode. As the meal progressed, Mrs. MacDonald noted that some of the drams remained untouched. "Come," she says, "finish your drinks, or I'll need to put them down the drain." A wee pause followed until a voice piped up from the end of the table, "I'm the drain." The most robust building is the stone-built old schoolhouse, last used in the 1950s, and now a private house. An earlier schoolhouse was much further on down the road. A small pitch-roofed corrugated iron building, still standing and once used temporarily as a school when the school was being constructed or refurbished. It was latterly occupied by the Cameron family, Katie, Alan and Rachel. They were each born and lived in the old Croft house just next door, now de-roofed and abandoned. In the young Cameron school days, there were 50 children in the school. 13 stayed across the river Caishnish, which was crossed by a bucket device suspended on a taut wire across the river. A teacher was once drowned using this. If the river was high, the children crossed by walking down to the rickety-rackety iron bridge aforementioned beside the turbine house, a mile downstream. 5 Kennedy children lived at Blaurahurran, of which 2 became teachers. There were 7 other Kennedys and a Charlie MacDonald who became a detective inspector. And Peggy McClellan, who lived at the toll house near Lundervrar. Katie's teacher was one Miss Cassells, a crabbit bitch, who regularly hit the children with a ruler. Over time, the rulers vanished from the classroom, prompting the teacher to commission Katie's father to make a new implement to leather the kids with. He cut a piece of willow about 2 feet long with knots in it, which Katie said was far worse than the ruler. The missing rulers may yet be found. They had been lost through the cracks in the floorboards. I've asked to be there when the house is being demolished. The Cameron family, Hugh and Sarah Cameron, had 5 children, in order Hugh, Alan, Rachel, Catherine, Katie, and Anna, Bella. The last survivor, Katie, was probably the last native Gaelic speaker about Fort William. She had no English until she went to school, where it was not encouraged. She could not read or write Gaelic. Their father Hugh was a severe man with a long beard, not encouraging of his children's independence, and living until the age of 94 years. Hence, all the children remained unmarried. He had been born at Tomi, now just a pile of stones down the road between Lundervrar and Kinlochleven. His wife, Sarah, was a MacGregor of the family who, as Cameron and MacGregor, ran horse-drawn coaches from the town to Arisaig. They were succeeded by A and J McPherson and later McCrae and Dick. Sarah died aged 77. Hugh had worked as a roadman in Glen Nevis for many years, walking 3 miles over the hill into Glen Nevis and back each day. It was here, sometime during the First War, but he found the body of the wee Cameron girl, who had drowned and had been washed down the river from Steele through the Nevis Gorge. The family lived in what is now known as Steele Hut, the climbing hut. She was aged 4 or 5 and had been playing outside the house raised above the River Nevis. It seems her mother thought she was with her father across the river, accessible over the wire bridge, and father thought the opposite. She went missing, and for weeks the glen and the river were searched to no avail. I was first told this story by John McInnes of Achanellan, Glenloy, who was once at Blamafulchuk. He said that Hugh Cameron was taking his daily route to work over the hill into Glen Nevis as dawn broke, when he saw an eerie light just downstream from the lower falls. As he approached, he went to the spot where he had seen the light and was led to the body of the girl lying in the stream bed, overhung by a high bank and branches. A less fanciful version of the story insists that whilst working in Glen Nevis, Hugh was scouring the riverbank looking for sticks to make up a brew when he saw the clothes of the girl on a branch overhanging the river. Even within living memory, a plain story can be embellished. I knew John was not prone to exaggeration, though it's recorded that John was once at a fank shearing sheep, discussing a new factor. "He's only got one eye," said a fellow shearer. "Ugh, that's no bloody good," says John. "He'll need 3 eyes if he's going to work about here." The eldest of the Camerons, Hugh, had just joined the local territorials when, on the day of the outbreak of World War I, he was called up. He never saw action, yet he lies in the small graveyard at the bottom of the next brae, in a military grave. He died in Colchester, where they were in training, billeted in primitive conditions with only straw and their greatcoats for bedding through the winter. Katie reported that his death was recorded as being from the black measles, meningitis and pneumonia. Hundreds apparently died there, and a Colonel Campbell was sent down to investigate. The military authorities wanted him buried in England, but his father insisted that he be brought home, and Katie remembered their horse-drawn cart, driven from the station by her father, arriving with his coffin at their house. His gravestone reads, "H. Cameron, Private 2172, First Lovett Scouts, who died Friday 26th of March 1915, aged 18. It is tended annually by the War Graves Commission when the grass is cut and the stone cleaned. Next brother, Alan, kept horses for ploughing up until the 1950s. He once broke some ribs when the plough hit a large stone and reared upwards, injuring his chest. Blamafulchuk was held up as one of the last places in Scotland where the Old New Year was celebrated on the 12th of January, well into the 1950s. And Katie recalled that Alan, as a young man, announced he was going down to the town to get his New Year bottle on the 31st of December. His father, Hugh, remonstrated with him. "But it's not time yet." "Ach," says Alan, "you can keep your old New Year. I'm moving with the times with the new New Year." Katie remembered he walked up from Fort William through the night, stopping at all the crofts on the way. Still had a drop left for his father when he arrived back in the morning. Katie spoke of the hungry stone, phonetically Clachan Achris. In summer, low down in the fields of the croft, perhaps when her father was cutting hay, which would be a clear, dry day, he would arrive in house for his lunch at exactly 12 noon. He could anticipate this time accurately, as the sun would be immediately above that stone, the hungry stone, at that time. It's on the north flank of Míol na Cléirigh, but is not the stone marked as the cairn on the map. She spoke of another stone seen on the skyline from a window on the northern ridge of Mullaghlin Carrion, phonetically Clachan Scrocchi, the slaughter stone, but no other information is offered. The family burned peat, taken from the original peat track, which led around to above Corrielochan, and from near the cattle grid. The other peat bank was on the flat ground east of the Caishnish, beyond the tributary that drains Lochland of Ra. Katie had only once been up Ben Nevis, as a young woman with 400 others, as was traditional at the time of the Glasgow Fair. Across the river, a small settlement of Bláth na Cléirigh was the summer house of summer home of Christine MacDonald, born Burnett, at her granny's. She remembered glorious weather and playing about the hay, a house, a dairy and outbuildings, and a granny who read out loud from a Gaelic Bible. She departed the croft in her coffin strung on the wires across the river. I remember visiting the house in the 70s, when beneath the failing slate roof lay a Gaelic Bible on a small table. A pine plantation had engulfed the house. Now felled, but now a second generation of trees will soon engulf the remaining stones. Part two will follow. Moving further up the road, above the cattle grid.